Nicholas Herman was born in 1614. He actually became very famous later in his life as Brother Lawrence. You've probably seen lots of pictures of this very famous monk named Brother Lawrence. He was actually born into poverty, so he was very, very poor. They didn't have anything, and so he was forced to join the army. And he joined the army in what a lot of you heard in school. You learned about this, the 30 Years' War. I don't know if you remember this in Europe. So there's this horrific like period for 30 years where France was at war with England. There was all kinds of stuff going on. And he enlisted. He fought in the war. He actually got arrested for being a spy at one point. He was going to be executed, but then he wasn't. He ended up getting wounded in his early 20s, and was discharged from the army at that point. And the horrors of what he had seen, the things he had experienced in this war, it kind of haunted him for the rest of his life. And in June of 1640, so he was 26 years old, he joined this monastic community. He said, you know, I've had enough of this. I'm going to go join this community. I'm going to be part of what goes on there. And 2 years later, he made his vows to spend the rest of his life as part of this. And this is where he took the name of Lawrence, which was the name of another saint, and he changed his name and took that. And for the next 50 years, he lived a simple life within this Parisian community. It was not a glamorous life at all. If you read what he wrote, Lawrence himself described, this is how he described himself, as a great, awkward fellow who broke everything. Right? So when he went in, his greatest fear when he went in was that he was going to get kicked out because he kept breaking stuff. Right? Like he thought he was going to go into the monastery, he was going to break things, they weren't going to want him, he was just going to be this big mess. He actually said they would skin him alive for his awkwardness and for all his faults. So he goes in, his primary assignments were working in the kitchen, and eventually he graduated because of his wounds and what he could do to making sandals. And so all through this time, he was awkward, he was rough, his war wounds got infected, they affected his mobility, he was emotionally scarred, he was doing work that had very little value in the world, and yet, the life he lived began to attract people from all over the country, who came to see what this guy was about and hear what he had to say. It's crazy. There was something different about him. I mean, he had wisdom, and people wanted to hear his wisdom. But what really attracted people to Lawrence was his attitude and his spirit, because he lived a life where he was contented, he was joyful, he was relaxed, he served people peacefully. He was one of those people that had that kind of winsome spirit that people just loved being around. And he had this joy that was infectious and a love of life that everybody wants, but few people find. And he learned how to live exactly, despite everything that had happened in his life, he learned to live with the kind of peace, the satisfaction, the joy, the love, the freedom that 400 years later, every single one of you and me wish we had. And what's crazy was he didn't do anything weird or different or new. He didn't have this formula that people came like, how do you do this? How do you live this way? It wasn't something that he simply practiced living the presence of God. And that's what he did. And he lived the kind of life that is available to you and to me. A life where we're peaceful, where we don't worry, where what we do has value no matter what it is that we're actually doing, where we're not beset by sins that we can't get past, that we're not, we know there's stuff, you know, that's really the kind of life that we crave this, a life where we're not continually wound up over relationship problems or politics or all these different things. So let me see if I can paint a picture for you. Anybody been on vacation yet this summer? Right? A few people have gone away. Some of you are like, what's a vacation? Okay. Come on, the DR was a vacation, right? No, that's not what I heard. Okay. So, you know what happens? I want you to picture, right? You're on vacation, and you go down wherever you like to go. Might be the shore, might be the mountains, might be, you know, way down south. I don't know. Wherever you like to go. And when you're in the middle of vacation, how do you feel? You feel relaxed, generally. That's why you like vacation. And you think to yourself, you know what? I'm at ease. I'm not worrying about anything. I know there's stuff to do at home, but it can wait till I get home. And if you're in a good place, you're like, it's vacation, let's eat out. You know, someone's like, can we afford that? Yeah, sure, it's vacation, we can do that, right? And you relax and you're sleeping in and you're taking it easy. And this is glorious week or two. And then you get back into the grind and you think, 4 more months until Christmas. And that's how you begin to live, right? I wonder that instead of living life where we have a week or two of highlights a year, that God's intention was that we should be living the kind of fulfilled life that looks more like vacation in terms of our attitude than what we normally do. Jesus, on the very last day before he died, before his crucifixion, he explained to his disciples exactly what this looks like. And in doing so, he really is asking this question, what occupies the place of highest daily priority in your life? And so the answer to that question is actually going to determine how we go through this, how we go through life. And so we're going to spend the next 4 weeks in these verses, these 10 verses. So I encourage you, read them over. It's John 15. Verses 1 to 10. Read them over and over. Soak in them during the week, because we're going to spend all of August looking at this. And so today, in the time we have, I just want to set it up. Kind of get it ready, right? Because you have to understand the context of where Jesus said these words. So what happened is, this is the last night of Jesus' life. So they've had the Last Supper, right? What we call the Last Supper. And Jesus has washed the disciples' feet. Remember, he does all that. He serves them. He's teaching them all these things about what they should do. He says, he gives them this bewildering array of instructions, right? They didn't even understand it. They probably thought that they were going to have lots of time for Jesus to explain more of this later, right? This is how you serve other people. I want you to love people the way I love them. I want you to know God. I want you to know the will of God. I want you to obey everything I've said. And he goes on and on. And they're probably listening to all this going, he's saying a lot, but I just am hungry, right? I want to eat right now, and he can tell us more later. But Jesus knew what was coming. And Jesus knew that within hours, he was going to be betrayed by one of his friends. He was going to be denied by one of his closest friends. They were all going to run away. They were going to leave him utterly alone. They were going to be fearful. He knew they were going to be scattered. They were going to be lacking direction. Even though he had said to them, I'm leaving, they didn't get it. They didn't understand what he was saying. It was quite clear. They were confused. They had no idea of the trauma that was going to be facing them in the next 6 hours. The question that was going to face them that Jesus knew they didn't even know was, how do you bounce back and move on from what was going to happen? And Jesus knew this. He knew he was going back to the Heavenly Father. And he could see not only what was going to happen in those next 6 hours, but he could look forward into the future and say, how are they going to deal with all this stuff and all the disappointments and all the problems of life and all the things that are going to happen? How are you going to do that? How are you going to live life in the face of all those things? And so they're walking to the garden. It says they left dinner and they're walking to the garden, the place where he's going to pray and then be arrested. And you can kind of picture, it's pure supposition, but it makes you wonder, if they're walking through and they're walking through a garden, he sees the vines, you know, the vineyards, because that was a big crop back then. And he decides to use a picture of what was right there, a metaphor of something that he knew. And he told them these words, and it's something that stuck with them for the rest of their lives, to the point that years later, John wrote it down, because people were saying, John, you got to write this stuff down. This is life-changing. Here's what he said. You heard it read earlier. I am the true vine, and my Father is the gardener. He cuts off every branch in me that bears no fruit, while every branch that does bear fruit, he prunes it, so it will be even more fruitful. You are already clean because of the words I have spoken to you. Remain in me, and I also remain in you. No branch can bear fruit by itself. It must remain in the vine. Neither can you bear fruit unless you remain in me. I'm the vine. You are the branches. If you remain in me, and I in you, you will bear much fruit. But apart from me, you can do nothing. If you do not remain in me, you are like a branch that is thrown away and withers. Such branches are picked up, thrown into the fire, and burned. If you remain in me, and my words remain in you, ask for whatever you wish, it will be done for you. This is to my Father's glory that you bear much fruit, showing yourselves to be my disciples. As the Father has loved me, so have I loved you. Now remain in my love. If you keep my commands, you will remain in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commands and remain in his love. Now, can you imagine hearing that for the first time and thinking, I don't get it? Or I get a little bit of it, or I kind of understand where he's going, but I don't fully grasp this. Well, Jesus is saying, look, let me give you a picture. He's giving a word picture, a metaphor. And like all, you know, word pictures and metaphors, you can't carry them too far. They break down. You got to look at what the intention is. So Jesus is doing something very specific there. This metaphor of, and he starts out with this. I am the true vine. My Father is the gardener. Okay? And this is something that every good Jew would understand. Because every Jew, and these guys were mostly Jew, all these Jews, they grew up in school. They went to, you know, they went to Sunday school and they heard all the stories. And throughout the Old Testament, God describes Israel, the Jewish people, as the vine, the vineyard. Right? The picture that God had given way back when was saying, Israel, you are my vineyard. I am going to lavish care and attention and protect you and build you. And as a result, you are supposed to bear the kind of fruit that changes the world. You're supposed to be a witness to the people around you. You're supposed to change the nations near you. That's what the purpose of Israel is. And Israel didn't. And there's repeated prophecies over and over how God said, well, I'm going to destroy the vineyard because the fruit that's coming off you is rotten. It's horrible. And I got to deal with this. And then there's prophecies how he's going to restore all this. So they understood the imagery. And what Jesus is now doing is he's taking all that and he's saying, you've heard all that? I'm the true vine. Not you, not the nation, not other people. It's in me. He's saying, I am the one who produces the kind of life and the kind of fruit that God intended. So here's the idea. It's the main idea for this morning. I want you to grab on this and hold it because it'll make all the difference. And it's simply this. Jesus is the only source of life that will not disappoint. Every other source of life that we grab onto will disappoint. And everything else we grab on is false. It'll let us down. By the way, you guys know this. It comes to everything, right? If our source of life is our jobs or our work, right? And you know that because when you're at work, you feel alive. You feel on. You're contributing. I mean, you are bringing life to this company. You are doing all the things you need to do. But then you feel like, oh, but I always got to be at my best. And what happens if I have an off day? And you know what? If I don't stay at my best, am I going to get fired? People are seeing me as valuable. But what if I'm not valuable? What if I'm not? And you have to deal with both sides. We don't want to fail. So we switch jobs at the earliest opportunity. We cut corners. We act unethically because we got to make sure that we still do what we do at work. Or what about money and stuff? We thought our source of life is having things. It's buying stuff. It's having nice stuff. And so we work hard and we work overtime and we do more here. We take cash under the table. We don't pay taxes on this and that because we got to have more because we want to buy more. Because when we do, it feels good. Right? That trip to the outlet mall and you come home and you go, it's been a good day. And it's by how many bags you put on the counter when you come in the door, right? But you know what happens then? That doesn't last very long and you got to do it again. And you got to do it again. And you got to buy more. And all of a sudden you're in debt and the credit cards are maxed out or you're working too much and life falls apart. It can be hobbies. It can be leisure. That can be your source of life. It's like, no, you know what? That's just work. I don't get hung up on that. I don't get hung in stuff, but I love to go to the shore. I love to be on my boat. I love to golf. I like to play music. And so everything kind of wraps itself around the hobbies and the things that we enjoy doing, whether it's sports, athletics, doesn't really matter what it is. And we end up living for the weekend and spending all our time and energy on these things and we become obsessed with them. Sometimes our source of life is negative stuff. We run to sinful habits to feel better. Because the only time we really feel better is when we go back to that habit, to that thing that we do. And it can even be religious. Following the rules, being involved at church. I got to do it. Every time the church is open, I'm there. Every time something's going on, I got to do stuff. Every time, I mean, I am the person who follows rules. I'm the person who does everything. I'm the person who serves wherever I can. I'm pouring my life out for other people. I'm pouring my life out for the church. And so we work harder, busier. And then when other people don't do the same thing, we get irritated. And we get disillusioned. And we get frustrated. Or we just feel proud and superior. Because we're just better Christians than all those other people. See, here's the thing. In the end, I cannot be my source of life. And every one of those things is me being the source of life. And Jesus is saying to his disciples, look, with what's coming, if you rely on anything other than me, you will be disappointed because it will not work and it will not fulfill your life. In the cross, everything we need for our past, because he dealt with all of our past, for the future, because he lived the life we were supposed to live and can't. And he died the death that we deserved but didn't. So that we can live a life and have access personally in that life to the source of life. That's why he'll never disappoint. This is a paradigm shifting for the disciples. So he goes on. He says, I'm the true vine. My father's the gardener. And then he says this. He cuts off every branch in me that bears no fruit, while every branch that does bear fruit he prunes, so it'll be even more fruitful. And he's kind of going on. He's like, okay, guys, God is the gardener. It sounds kind of threatening at first, doesn't it? He's the gardener. He's going to cut off branches. That wasn't his point. He's saying, look, my father is the gardener. He cares enough that he is totally invested in this process. I would think of it this way. God's desire for us is actually that we have a daily experience of that source of life. He wants that for us. He wants that deep. Consider it. He sent his son. He was so interested in you having access to the source of life that he took his own son, who he loved, and said, I am sending you to go die in their place. Because the disciples needed to know they were coming up on chaos, problems, pain, future persecution. And what they needed to understand in the middle of all that life, and you guys know this because you go through life, and life isn't good all the time. He said, what you need to understand in the midst of all that is my Father is for you, not against you. Because it feels sometimes like he is stacking all the decks against us. It's not true. He says, I'm the true vine, and my father's the gardener. He's the one who's active. He's the one who's doing this. He's at work because he cares for you. So I would say it this way. Every action God takes with you is for your benefit. Think about that. Every action that God takes for you is for your benefit. Then he goes on, he actually makes this really interesting connection, because then in verse 3, he says, you're already clean because of the words that I've spoken to you. He was basically saying, look, you've been living with me for 3 years, you've been in a relationship with me, you're following me, you're trusting me. That's the way it's supposed to be. You're already clean because you've been doing the things that you're supposed to do. Right? He's making this connection because what he's trying to tell them is, just like it's been going on, everything we've been doing for the last 3 years, that's what I want you to keep doing. Remember Peter when Jesus said, do you want to leave me? Everybody was abandoning him. He said, Peter, do you want to go? And Peter said, where would we go? You have the words of life. He's saying, that guys, that's how I want you to live. Basically, he's saying the kind of relationship that allowed God to care for them, they were followers of Jesus. And even though his physical presence was getting gone, they didn't know this yet, they were still to stay tied to him. He said, don't walk away, don't run away, because here's the truth. We experience God then by remaining in Jesus. This is what we're going to be looking at for the next 4 weeks. This idea of remaining in Jesus. Because as you face your life, and as you encounter all the stuff that goes on, whether it's the good things, the bad things, as you go through the struggles and the pains and all the problems, because let's be honest, when things are good, that's not what drives us away from God. We get distracted. But where we begin to question is when we go through all this stuff in life, and it's like Jesus is setting his disciples up saying, you don't know what's coming, but I want you to remember this principle, and I want you to remember this. And by the way, he uses this term, remain in me, this is where we're going to camp. Take a look at how many times it's in these 10 verses. He says, remain in me. And then he says, if you want to, no branch can bear fruit because it has to remain in the vine. You can't bear fruit unless you remain in me. If you remain in me, if you do not remain in me, if you remain in me, if you remain in my love, if my words remain in you, there's obviously something pretty critical about this word. Right? And it talks about dwelling and being together. We're going to unpack that a little bit more next week. But, he says, when you go through life, don't let the problems of life drive you from Jesus. Let them drive you to Jesus. Because it's going to be one or the other. But the only way you're going to let it drive you to Jesus is if you buy into the fact that the only source of life is Jesus. And that the Father is doing everything for your benefit because He wants to let you. He wants you to have you experience that life all the time. Jesus is saying, I'm going to endure death. I'm going to endure separation from God on the cross so that you, in the midst of all the problems of this life, don't have to. So, where are you at today? As we close, as we wrap up this morning, I want you to be thinking about this. And here's what we're going to do. Because Jesus is the only source of life that won't disappoint. I want you to think of this question. I wonder what gets you out of bed in the morning. What excites you? I mean, what gets you going? What are you chasing? What drives your behavior? How are you dealing with the problems and the sins in your life? And is your source not completely maybe where it should be? See, Jesus is the only source of life that won't disappoint. And the Father is fully committed to you and to bringing you into a life that conforms to Jesus, the one that John Sober spent 4 weeks telling us about. He wants us to come into that kind of life. So when we embrace Jesus, we remain in Him, we let the difficulties or even just the daily grind of life drive us towards Him instead of away from Him. So, we're going to close. We're going to have a couple songs, a couple worship songs. But here's what I want you to do. I want you to process this. Just spend some time. If you want to stand, you can stand, but you can remain seated. You can pray. I want you to think about where your source of life is. If there's anything blocking, what you desire from God. And just tell Him, hey, God, this is what I wish I had and I don't have it. Because we're going to be looking at what it means to abide. We're going to look at what does that look like? How do we do that? What's our role in it? What God's role? And what does it do when we do that? And that's what we're going to be doing over the next 3 weeks.